This is Fresh Air. Philip Glass has set the poems of Allen Ginsberg to music in a new work called Hydrogen Jukebox. The piece has its world premiere at the Spoleto Festival in South Carolina and will have its concert premiere later this month at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia. Yesterday, the composer and the poet were in Chicago, where they did a benefit performance for the Buddhist group Jewel Heart. They came to the NPR Bureau in Chicago to talk with us about working together. Allen Ginsberg started off the story of how they met.
Well, let's see. My first contact with this collaboration was in the St. Mark's Bookshop in New York City when Philip Glass and I bumped into each other. And what did you tell me then?
Well, the Avetco Company, which is a theater company that was organized by Tom Bird, it's a Vietnam Veterans Theater Company, had asked me to participate in a benefit. And I suggested that maybe I could do something with you, and they asked me whether we could get one of your Vietnam period pieces and that I could do some music with. And I ran into your bookstore, and I said, Alan, what do you think of this idea?
And then the bookstore had my poems, so I pulled down a copy of, I think, Collected Poems, and pointed out a specific passage which had a lot of musical possibilities because it had big, interesting, melodramatic dynamics. Yeah. And I gave it to you or something?
Yeah, at that time. And then
a little copy of the book, that's right, the City Lights book.
You made a recording of it.
Yeah.
I work with the recording, and I made a piano setting for Alan's reading, which was then premiered, I think, that June. We're talking about June of 88 now, mm-hmm. at the Schubert Theater for that benefit.
What was the poem?
Wichita Vortex Sutra, and it was the central passage driving through the middle of Kansas, talking to myself, saying if the president can send troops over there and declare war on Indochina, I can undeclare it, because he doesn't have any legal right, and I haven't got any legal right, so it's simply up to us to assert our different direction of will, so to speak, or our different vision of the universe. And my poetic vision was going to outlast him, I thought. So I here declare the end of the war.
That poem's in your Hydrogen Jukebox.
Well,
isn't it?
Turns out to be, because what happened is after this small collaboration, we enjoyed it a lot, and it was very successful. And I suggested, Alan, that we do a longer piece. Or he suggested to me, or what?
Well, we were doing a lot of benefits for Buddhist organizations, mm-hmm. Buddhist meditation centers, as we are this week for Jewel Heart in Chicago. And so I thought, well, maybe we should work up a little repertoire so that we wouldn't have to repeat things over ourselves.
Well, the piece we ended up doing, it turned out to be for six singers and a small ensemble. And it covered, a lot of the poems in Collected Poetry. Well, it doesn't cover the poetry.
It covers a span of poems over maybe 30 years, actually.
That mostly are found in Collected Poems.
Alan, can I ask you to read one of the poems that's included in Hydrogen Jukebox? And I'd like you to read the opening of To Aunt Rose.
Okay. Yes,
this is one of your early poems. It's from 1958.
Well, that's 1958, that'd be early, is Aunt Rose, now might I see you with your thin face and buck-tooth smile and pain of rheumatism and a long black heavy shoe for your bony left leg limping down the long hall in Newark on the running carpet past the black grand piano in the day room where the parties were, and I sang Spanish loyalist songs in a high squeaky voice, hysterical, the committee listening while you limped around the room, collected the money, Aunt Honey, Uncle Sam, a stranger with a cloth arm in his pocket and huge, young, bald head of Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
What was going on in your life and in your writing in 1958 when you wrote this poem?
I was in Paris. My Aunt Rose, this was 1958, my Aunt Rose had died and was buried in Newark in 1940. And now I was all grown up, and I suddenly had flashed on the phantom of my old Aunt Rose, whom I loved a great deal, kind of surrogate mother, and realized it was almost two decades that she'd gone to the Yellow Springs, and suddenly felt a twinge of ancient Parisian nostalgia for being alive, and an awareness of what a precious thing it was, and how exquisite my memories of her were, and just began talking to her, or thinking of talking to her. I said, well, this would make an interesting piece of... I never wrote about this before. How come I never wrote about my dear old Aunt Rose?
And what was going on in your writing?
Well, it was a very productive period. I had come from San Francisco. I was with William Burroughs, Gregory Corso, and Peter Orlovsky living about half a block from the Seine River in a little tiny furnished room where we all had little rooms, $30 a month, near a market, so we could cook on a one-burner gas stove. And Gregory Corso was writing his poem, Marriage. Burroughs was putting together Naked Lunch. Peter was writing his first poem. I was writing European poems like Nostalgic Recollections of America, or a poem on Apollinaire's Grave, or a poem on the new Sputnik that had just gotten up off the ground. So it was just sort of an American in Paris, classic situation, recalling ancient dead days of New Jersey.
Philip Glass, how much did you talk about this poem with Allen Ginsberg before writing the music setting for it?
You mean specifically? I don't think we talked specifically about it. I'm sure that Allen read it for me, because one of the things that we did together during the month or so that we were putting together let's call it the libretto of the opera, one of the things we did was sit and, not only did we pick out the poems, but Allen read them to us, or read them for us. One of the things that I was anxious to do, we talked about these themes of, let's say, just generally like...
Family, in this case, I think.
In this case...
personal matter rather than giant.
Right, we thought that one of the polarities of the piece was the personal as well as the public. So that, and I liked the poem very much because it was so much about something, a very private part of Allen's world, rather than the very public part that most people maybe know about. I thought of what has become the Hydrogen Jukebox, which has become Hydrogen Jukebox, as really a portrait of America at the end of the 20th century. And one of the things that I was anxious to do, and one of the reasons I got the idea of launching into this big piece with Allen, was that right after the last presidential elections, when none of the candidates seemed to be willing to talk about the world that we lived in, I wanted to be involved with a piece that really talked about the American landscape that everybody knew about, and that the politicians were seemed to be afraid to talk about.
When you were writing music as a setting for Ginsberg's poems, did it change the lines of your music at all?
Oh, sure.
What effect did it have on your lines?
For me, the rhythm of the American language is the key to how these things are said. And just listening to Allen read this last poem, though he'll tell you, I'm sure, that my settings aren't the same as the way he reads it, but it really, on the other hand, they're not that different either. What I was most intent on doing was respecting the music that was already in the words. In other words...
How do you relate your music, which involves a certain amount of mantric repetition, how do you relate that to the text that's set before you?
Usually, as a kind of screen
against which the music.
There are
the
two
words.
Things. For one thing, there is the words themselves, which need to be said in the most natural way. There is that part, but there's another part to it too, which is the actual musical, let's say, ambience or environment that the words are set into. For example, in the poem about Aunt Rose that you just read, what I did is I picked a rhythm which was it was a 5/8 rhythm, 1-2-3, 1-2, 1-2-3, 1-2, kind of a lopsided rhythm. And I got that idea of the rhythm from the description of her foot in the long...
Aunt Rose, now might I see you, Aunt Rose, now
but
might I see
But it's also the picture of someone who walks with a limp.
Right.
The 1-2-3, dot. It's an uneven walk.
And a long black heavy shoe.
And I thought of the uneven walk of the person in the long shoe, and I thought of the uneven rhythm. And in a way, that one specific thing, the only specific relation of the music to the words is that, but it's a very specific one.
Uh-huh.
And once I get one, you see, the thing is that when you do a portrait in music, you don't have to do a complete portrait. All you have to do is an indication. And mostly we, as listeners, will fill in the rest.
So the music and the words intersect.
They really do.
Philip, what do you think Allen Ginsberg brings out in your work? And Allen, what do you think Philip brings out in your work? Working together, do you think that you are having an influence on each other?
Well, it's been important for me to, I've have a reputation for doing, I've done pieces that have about social issues, but I've often used very obscure languages, Sanskrit, Egyptian, and just sometimes just numbers. Latin, Italian. They're so obscure, but for an American audience, they could be. What's really important for me is not only to work with subject matter which is very relevant, which I've been always interested in doing, but to do it in an American language.
And a very colloquial one, I think.
Yeah, and for me, Alan's writing is a kind of a godsend for that purpose, because it is, in fact, sometimes in the Wishita Sutra, in the Wishita Vortex piece, you talk about inventing an American language.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking yesterday, and Alan, you were talking about how language and music had gotten separated, and
since the times of Homer and Sappho, you know, and the Greek
in a way,
plays.
Sometimes, if we can just to bring them together in again, and it can be such a powerful it's such a powerful effect when they do come together.
Ellen, you've actually been using music for your poems for years now. Not
kind
all
of
the
amateur,
time, but
you
often.
Know, kind of amateur Rhine ballads and blues and things like that.
Does it give you any new insights into your poems to hear Philip Glass's music?
Yeah, actually, it frames them kind of shining in silver in sort of dignified way, so you get the highlights, the highlights of poems or whole poems which are presented, rather than just sort of sitting there on the page or some byproduct of beatnik frenzy. They're actually presented in a dignified, straightforward way so that an audience can hear it, hear the words, take it seriously, and see it in the context of art rather than some kind
so
of personal
like
neurosis.
Taking your photographs and putting them in frames and putting them in the museum.
Yeah. It makes kind of museum pieces or operatic pieces out of it.
Maybe that isn't so good.
Well, no, I don't. My impulse is operatic.
Uh-huh.
You know, but melodrama. We were talking about the word melodrama.
Yeah.
My impulse is melodramatic, to dramatize melodically certain moments of recollection or perception, like Aunt Rose. That's melodramatic. I mean, you wake up in Paris and say, oh, my old aunt in Newark 18 years ago, and she's under the grave.
You know, one of the things you both have in common is that you're both Buddhists, yes?
Yes.
And another thing you have both in common is that you're both born Jewish.
And both of probably Eastern European or Middle European parents.
Probably our grandfathers live within a few miles of each other.
My grandfather sold peace goods to your grandmother.
Something like
in somewhere in the near the Lithuanian border.
Oh. Allen Ginsberg, can I ask you to read another excerpt of the poems that are in Hydrogen Jukebox, and this is the second poem.
Yeah, toward the beginning of the opera, and actually
it's an excerpt of a longer poem, isn't it?
Right, it's from Iron Horse from 67, and it's really actually a timely now with the switcheroo from the Cold War, or going back and forth in the Cold War, to say war on drugs, or a war on the underclass, or a war on porn, or war on. Who's the enemy? Year after year, war after war. Who's the enemy? What's the weapon? Battle after battle. What's the news? Defeat after defeat. What's the picture? Decade after decade. Who's the enemy? Year after year.
Philip, do you want to say anything about the music you wrote for this poem?
Well, this is one of the first pieces that I worked on, and when I began working on this, I really wasn't sure how the words and the music were going to match up, and how this was one of the ones that convinced me that I was going to be able to carry out the project, because it's one where the setting for the music came so easily for me.
It's one of the most beautiful pieces in the opera, I think.
Mm-hmm.
This one you've almost made into a chant because it repeats itself.
Well, I repeated it in reading it, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You both have drawn on international influences in your work, and I'm wondering, with Glasnost, with the changes that are happening in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if your traveling has changed at all, your sense of your ability to travel, your sense of where your audiences are, who can read, who can perform your work?
Well, my work kind of traveling, let's say working internationally, has been going on for so long now, since the early 70s, I don't know that the recent events have impacted London so directly, though now there are possibilities of working in Eastern Europe and that there weren't so much before. I would say for me it's too soon to say what those differences will be. I've preferred, actually, to tell you the truth, I like working in America. I like working at home. I always felt a bit of an exile during the 70s when I was doing so much work abroad.
Mm-hmm. I've been feeling that the fruition of a lot of the spiritual art of America of the 60s and 70s is coming now in Eastern Europe and in the totalitarian countries as the totalitarian regimes are being overthrown. And in my own situation, my own poetry is now being liberated to be performed and broadcast. So later this month I'm going to Prague. Well, there'll be, at the end of April, a whole evening of my poetry related to the May King festivals.
Alan, isn't it ironic that you're having these battles with the FCC at home at the same time?
Yeah, it's really amazing. Just as my poetry can be broadcast in Prague or even Moscow, and I have a sort of hit record of Howl in Hungary, in the Hungarian language, my poetry has been banned by Jesse Helms with the new infamous law, again, barring indecent language 24 hours a day on the airwaves, which has now effectively chilled most of my poetry off National Public Radio and Pacifica and listener-supported stations. All the poems that are in the Norton Anthology and the Oxford Anthology no longer can be broadcast because of the new FCC chilling regulations.
Mm-hmm. One last question about your collaborations together. When you're performing together, can you pick out in the audience who's more so the Ginsberg fan and who's more so the Glass fan?
I can't really. Sometimes when we do these pieces together, these concerts together, I'll play for a part of the program and Alan will read for part of the program. But I look at the audience and it looks like the audiences I generally see anyway. There are a lot of young people come to these and Alan has a very big following among young people. We both do.
Phil's got all those people in the audience with nose rings and golden earrings and long hair and punk costumes. And I have all the Jewish Altacockers with gray hair and beards that are nodding sympathetically at East European high culture.
No, the beatniks are all Alan's.
They are not. The acid heads are all yours. We divvy it up.
Well, Alan Ginsberg, Philip Glass, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Alan Ginsberg and Philip Glass's collaboration, Hydrogen Jukebox, will have its concert premiere this month at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia, and its world premiere next month at the Spoleto Festival. Today, Alan Ginsberg is in Washington, D.C., participating in a discussion on FCC regulation of broadcast speech. Ginsberg is speaking against the Helms Amendment, which prohibits the broadcast of indecent material anytime during the broadcast day. This is Fresh Air.